Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. 5 days a week, you will find us right here. 5 to 7 Central Time, that's in Texas and whatnot, and 6 till 8 Eastern, and 3 till 5 Pacific Time. Also, for those of you listening in New Zealand at the moment, it is 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday, and also in Ifinity FM in the South Island, I believe Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 3 a.m. in the late night, coast-to-coast style, when all the conspiracy theorists are still awake. So, there are many places you can go to listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and I recommend, personally, going directly to the archives at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. They're all free, and there is a huge, ridiculously long list of incredible guests just in the normal radio archives, let alone the featured interviews, and also Kiwi collaborators, which are all a list of very, very nice Kiwi guests who've got very nasty information and stuff to say about the government. Now, today we have a very special guest, hopefully shall be making an appearance soon enough. And I believe the pronunciation that George Norrie was using was Andrew Brashago. And the time travel question. Now, many people have seen movies where time travel is involved. There have been TV series like 7 Days. There have been things like Stargate or Stargate SG-1 and all these spin-offs and what have you. And now there's a new film coming out called Looper, which chronicles the life of basically a time travel-involved assassin getting paid in silver only in a post-collapse United States in the 2040s of some description. Now, the concept has been introduced since the early days of the book known as the Time Traveler, and even now it's getting romanticized in movies like The Time Traveler's Wife. Now, you wonder, where do the movies get all their creative ideas from, considering they're doing things like Rocky Six? Is there any creativity left in Hollywood? My bet is not. So it's quite logical to assume that there might be a possibility that the concepts for these films and things of that nature are in fact based somewhere in reality. Now, Andrew is an author. He's a lawyer. He's got standing in the community and things like that. And he's come out and turned whistleblower to essentially make sure that people know about the realities of time travel in our time. And I believe that he's just arrived now and probably hasn't heard any of my elaborate introduction. Suffice to say, well, there's a little bit of feedback on your end there, Andrew. You might want to just turn your speakers down a little bit, and that should be fine. Suffice to say, there's a shrinking thread that separates reality from fiction. And I think movies are kind of bridging the gap in a lot of those ways and stealing their ideas from things that are, in fact, really happening. And I was talking about a lot of time travel movies that have recently come out. So, Andrew Brashago, I believe, is that how you pronounce your name? Welcome to the show.
Hi, Vincent. It's actually pronounced Brashago, like Chicago.
Oh, yeah. But you're not also controlled by the mob, are you? Like Chicago?
No, there are very few Polish Americans in the mafia.
Okay.
Very few.
Okay. I'll take your word
Perhaps
for
none.
It. Okay. Well, let's get it off to a nice giggling and chuckling start, because the information that you're about to reveal, and we have close to 2 hours to expand on this, and I don't want to waste any of your valuable time, Andrew, but could you please, for the audience and those who might not be aware, just give us a little bit of background and why you kind of came forth to talk about your previous time travel experience?
Actually, the whys and the wherefores are very experiential, because I didn't have a plan to come forward per se. What happened was I got caught up in the early days of time-space exploration by the U.S. government as a child. Between ages 7 and 11, which was for me from 1968 to 72. And when I was a child on the project, ultimately, I essentially began my truth campaign, in the sense that I was disturbed by the way in which the children in the program were being handled. And I made several efforts as a school child, actually, to subvert the project. And that campaign continues in our own time, with measures that I'm taking as an adult to bring to public light the existence of the project. The project was Project Pegasus, which was a classified research and development program, a defense-related research and development program, under the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And in that context, I first teleported between New Jersey and New Mexico with my late father, Raymond, who was a special projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company, which was the principal defense contractor involved in enabling the U.S. government to achieve a time-space capability by 1967-68, because it was in that time frame that we first teleported from the old Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey, to the Santa Fe, New Mexico State Capitol grounds, from where we obtained an automobile and drove to the Los Alamos National Labs for the meeting with Dr. Harold M. Agnew, who was then the director of the weapons division of the labs. He would go on and become the director of the Los Alamos Labs in 1970. But in 1967-68, he was still directing the weapons division, the W division. And that meeting involved my father presenting a prospectus to Dr. Agnew to begin testing the teleportation capability that had just arisen in the U.S. defense technical community, based on the latter works of Nikola Tesla, on civilians, including adults and children. And my dad essentially took me along on that jump through a vortal tunnel in time-space, which we were enabled to do via a Tesla device back at Curtis Wright, to present that prospectus. In adulthood, when I began to, I was sort of impeded professionally after many years of education and professional attainment. And so in my late 30s, I began going back and re-examining what I had been involved in as a school child, which essentially ran the gamut from remote viewing all the way to physical time travel. And there were 8 different modalities involved in Project Pegasus. So in my late 30s, around the year 2000, I began really focusing on what had happened, what I had been caught up in. And I realized it was of really momentous historical significance because I was a direct participant in the development of time travel by the U.S. government. And I was able, as a result of my keen mind as a child, I had been selected for one reason, because I had a superb memory. And I was able to observe things, participate in things, and then remember what happened accurately and report back with a good memory of what happened. So I'm able now to describe the people, the places, the time travel technologies, and my experiences, demonstrating that, in fact, the Project Pegasus was the secret twin of Project Manhattan. Some of the very people who gave the Allied war effort the atomic bomb and worked on nuclear weapons after the war were also elaborating the different devices that Nikola Tesla left in his paperwork. So that 25 years after Tesla's death, they had a teleportation capability. I was engaged in the process of publicly revealing my experiences so that I could lobby the U.S. government to declassify and deploy teleportation. For many years, I had performed my investigation roughly from around the year 2000 to 2004. I had done three major fact-finding trips to New Mexico, where I discovered all manner of evidence that established that what I was remembering was accurate, that it was about things that had actually happened. I began lecturing in 2004, and so by 2005, I had essentially, just starting locally in my own community, lecturing and then doing small podcasts on behalf of different broadcasters. Ultimately, I worked my way up to where I was featured on Coast to Coast AM, the largest radio show in the world. And as a result of that notoriety, two individuals who had worked with me during a second phase of time-space exploration, namely our guest or co-guest today, Bernard Mendez, and William B. Stillings, who I had worked with in the CIA's Mars Jump Room program of the early 80s. First, William B. Stillings and then Bernard Mendez contacted me in 2010 and 2011. And so for the last several years here, we've been in communication, and we've gone back and we've established the history of...
Well, I think this is actually the perfect time to introduce Bernie Mendez. He's here as well, UFOQ&A.com. Bernie, I forgot to introduce you earlier. Welcome. Bernie, are you there? We can't hear you, mate.
That's okay.
Oh, there you go.
Right.
Okay. So you know you've been a confidant and partnering with Andrew for some time. So how did your relationship start?
Well, I was scheduled to go out to the West Coast Jump Room is when I first met Andrew, because I was in the East Coast Jump Room and we had a lot of mishaps. We had a few casualties, so. He said to go out to the West Coast Jump Room. There's a few things I needed to check anyway. I had a checklist of questions to ask the instructor, Major Dames, for the instructions of the administration. And then more things came up because I was reading more and more reports about the Jump Room activities. There were 40 reports a month, and then it spiked up to 70 reports. Those were the jumps that Andrew was going on. There were reports of creatures and some other things going on. So I need some time off. I said, go have some fun out in the West Coast. You'll find the people out there a lot nicer. And then, on my way, I went. I had to stop off at Ohio, to check on something. Tom, they were having some problems in the West Coast. Sometimes the jump room wasn't working properly. It was down. There was a power loss someplace. And Tom was working on it. So I had to stop by and talk to Tom about this. Ask him if he needed anything, because the government appropriations bill was coming up very shortly, a $1 trillion appropriation. And and then before that, there was another debriefing. Something else happened. So I got a late start to begin with. And then when I finally got to see Tom, and we went over a few things, there were more incidences. The West Coast jump room went down. They're supposed to jump that day, about 10 o'clock in the morning. And that was delayed until late in the afternoon. And I got there very late. I spoke to Tom, asked him what he needed. needed some spare parts and some other problems, and we discussed this power loss that was happening periodically. The room was going down. And if he had any clues as to why it was going down, that the administration wanted to nail it down. And what did he need to find out more about this? It boiled down to a lot of manpower being placed in specific locations and then determining where exactly this was happening. I already had made up my mind what was causing it, but that was another story altogether. So off I went, arrived at the West Coast Jump Room. It was supposed to be about 10 o'clock. Actually, I would have been there about 8 o'clock, but it was delayed, and it was 10 o'clock. We made the jump right away, too. And then they went down, and that's when I first met Andrew and everyone else in the class. And it was late in the afternoon. I was tired. I'd already been up 3 days. So we went to the barracks, and, you know, we got some sleep. And me and Andrew introduced ourselves to one another. We were talking in the classroom about what was going on. We were talking about Mars. We were talking about what it all meant, what we were all doing. But little did we know, things were about to take a turn for the more complicated. There were more and more things that were going to happen to us on the jumps, and more issues and more involvement with other creatures and other areas. Little did we know. But I was already suspicious about it. There were a few reconnaissance reports about the jump room, especially on the East Coast, that the reports were that the area we went to looked different. The trees, the flower, and the floor in the area looked different. It looked like we were in a different area for some reason. We didn't know why or how. And I was getting suspicious. So I've asked any other reports of this nature where people gone to the area or jumped to a specific location and looked different. And that's when we're pulling together all this information and trying to sort it out. And that'll be the next jump I made with Andrew. You want to elaborate on that, Andrew?
We won't have the time, unfortunately. We're just coming up to break. So if you'd like to hold that thought, and we'll save it and expand on it when we come back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You can join us in the chat room at TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com, or if you Google Vinny Eastwood, the CIA knows where to find me, and now you can too. We'll be right back, folks.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know. The way it's going to go.
Well, most of us don't anyway. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
We can see.
To the Vinny Eastwood Show. The show where you don't know which way it's going to go and the way that you can't see how it's going to be. And I think that got us very appropriate for the topic we're broaching on here with time travelers. So, yeah, hey, I can. I've been there, bro. I can see the way it's going to be. I don't know. Maybe that makes a difference. Maybe not. Over the break, we were talking about mind control and how when you are subjected to these programs that are of an incredibly secret nature, obviously, you would have to undergo some form of indoctrination or mind control so that so suddenly there ain't hundreds of people that are involved in these projects all over the place who can just willy-nilly start talking the truth about this thing. And the trick is, in order to beat your mind control, you got to figure out, hey, well, hold on a second, am I under mind control? And there's a lot of elements to it that I don't fully understand. But I would like, Andrew, if you could, to expand on that, if you would.
Well, the form of mind control that was used in the Mars Jump Room program was simply brainwashing with compartmentalization. They trained us in the summer of 1980 in a summer seminar under Major Ed Dames at College of the Siskiyous in Weed, California. And I can describe for you who was there and at least many of the participants and what we studied. But after that training course that summer, we were basically brainwashed to compartmentalize our experiences so that as I had my Mars jump room experiences really for the entire time I was an undergraduate at UCLA between 1980 and 84, there wasn't any spillover between my life basically as a chrononaut for the U.S. Navy, essentially, in this CIA-administered program, and my collegiate life. They were two separate existences, so to speak. Then I remember after the last jump in spring of 84, I was subjected to more attempts to suppress my memory before leaving the building in which the West Coast jump room was located. It was located in a, Bernie described the fact that there was an East and a West Coast jump room. In fact, there were, with a control center in Ohio. I remember when we were teleporting across country, there was a control center in Solon, Ohio. So maybe, in fact, that was the same facility. So it wasn't until, while I remembered my childhood experiences in Project Pegasus from the time they occurred between 1968 and 72, indeed I had told some of my junior high school, college, law school, and graduate school friends and classmates what I had experienced. I even presented a lecture on my teleportation experiences to my seventh grade English class. However, 10 years later, beginning in 1980, at that point, the U.S. government's ability to brainwash individuals and involve them in secret programs, and then brainwash them again so they were returned to their civilian life with very little understanding of what they had participated in, was far more advanced. So it wasn't until William Stillings contacted me on April 23rd of 2010 that we began to piece together what had begun for us in my second chapter as a chrononaut, Brett's first, beginning in that summer 1980 training program. Now, what Bernie was just describing before we went to break was really some information from that era and then some information from a night run that we did in 1983. So let me go back to 1980 and tell you what we know. We have three U.S. chrononauts who have come forward who were classmates, who were literally co-participants in the jump room and its visits to the surface of Mars or wherever they were sending them. So this is unprecedented. We literally have three individuals who were trained together. That would be like three astronauts who had been in the same space capsule. So we've identified amongst ourselves, we've jogged our memories and gotten past that brainwashing. And we know the following. We agree that the instructor was Major Ed Dames, the remote viewing pioneer, who was then a scientific and technical intelligence officer for the U.S. Army. We know the names and the identities of five of the 10 teenagers in the training class. In addition to myself, born in 1961, there was a young African-American from Hawaii who was then attending Occidental College named Barry Satoru, who we now know as President Barack Obama, the 44th President of the United States. And in addition to Barry, as we called him, and myself, there was a young woman who had just entered Caltech, the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California, at age 16, a prodigy by the name of Regina Dugan. Now, Regina Elvira Dugan is the woman that President Obama appointed the director of DARPA, the first female director of DARPA, on July 20th of 2009. Then there was a young teenager. Brett Stillings was only 13. He was born in 1966. So Brett was only 13 when we began training in summer of 80. And there was a young man, again, from around that 1961 birth year that Barry and I shared, who was then had just spent his first year at the Naval Academy at Annapolis. He was born 5 days after me on September 23rd of 1961, named William Cameron McCool. Willie McCool was the pilot of the Columbia, the space shuttle that disintegrated upon reentry to Earth's atmosphere on February 1st of 2003. So there was a future astronaut in our training program. Now, in addition to those five young people, there were five more. And we're still trying to work, you know, do our memory work and get a handhold on the names of those individuals. But we have a couple of clues. But we don't want to come forward yet with who they were. We might be able to identify one more because we think we have his name and his physical appearance. Now, in addition to those 10 young people, there were three parents who were always there for that summer training program. My father, Raymond, who was then employed by the Ralph M. Parsons Company. He had a background as essentially the principal technical liaison between Parsons and the CIA on teleportation. So clearly he was somebody who had technical insight into the jump room structure and function. Then there was William B. Stilling's father, Thomas J. Stilling, who was then employed as an operations analyst for Lockheed Skunk Works in Burbank, California. And I believe that was the Tom that Bernie was referring to in regard to try to resolving some of these power losses that the jump rooms were experiencing. Then there was the mother of Barack Satoru slash Obama, a very brilliant and charming woman by the name of Stanley Ann Dunham, the very Stanley Ann Dunham who appears in the Obama birther controversy as his biological mother, as indeed she was. In fact, I'm not only certain, or we're not only certain that it was Barack Obama's mother, but all three of us attended an afternoon lecture she gave on cross-cultural communications, which they thought we would need in the event we had face-to-face encounters with Martian humanoids. There's three types up there. So Barack Obama's mother, she gave a lecture on describing how she had married a Kenyan and then an Indonesian, and she had much to share, many insights to share, and she did, regarding cross-cultural communication. Now, there was a very unique individual who joined our class several days after we first convened, and he was introduced by Major Dames, and he was wearing a kind of a casual Army uniform with a sweater and epaulettes and a green cap and Army boots, who was described as somebody who was going to be investigating the jump room program. And Major Dames described how this is somehow, this was one of the ways in which the U.S. government sometimes investigated agencies or programs, which was by literally dropping an investigator into the program as a participant. And that individual was introduced as Bernard Mendez. So Bernie was there with a military escort or guard, but of course Ed Dames was his escort in the sense that he was there to report and interact with Ed Dames to try to determine what was going on in the jump room program. But those are the individuals who we were in the seminar with for 3 weeks in summer of 80. There's a complication, and I'm sorry, I have to elaborate here because somebody's going to try to challenge the validity of my account if I don't explain this in the same breath, and that is several days before that, those 3 weeks ended, the seminar ended, my father and Ed Dames approached Barry Obama, let's just call him that, Barry Satoru, as it were, Regina Dugan and myself, and explained that we were going to be teleported to the beginning of the summer so that we could spend 3 months in seclusion at the college, basically June, July, and August, rejoining the group in early September so that we could contribute to a threat assessment of the Martian humanoid civilization that the CIA was then authoring. And in fact, Bernard read that threat assessment. So that's the kind of corroboration we've established here. And so we were, and I remember that Barry and Regina were somewhat concerned about teleporting. I had done a lot of it as a child, so I wasn't that intimidated by the prospect of teleporting just a couple months earlier in the same locale, namely, you know, the Shadow region there. And Ed Dames said, "I know you arrived there safely because I've already met with you." He had already met with us in June of that very year when we teleported through from late August to work on, that document. So I got to know Barry Obama very well. In fact, we roomed together for a period of time. We got to know Regina very well. And they're very wonderful people. I can say that among my college peers, Barack Obama and Regina Dugan, quality people. They were really gifted, intelligent, compassionate people. And so I'm not speaking out from a sort of a post-Vietnam kind of anti-government vein. I'm speaking out because we may need some of these technologies to address the environmental crisis, and because it needs to be established socially that this program was launched and that these technical capabilities were achieved. But in any case, we were sequestered there, going backward in time and then forward in time just in the natural way for several months. And what do you know? A few days before the program ended, we walked into the classroom and suddenly we were there right after having left. And I had said to Brett Stillings, "You won't believe this, but they're having us study a foreign language." I think the documents were written in French. So all of us had French in junior high and high school. But I was by no means fluent even in written French, and so I was struggling through the source documents in French in order to draft my thesis, which was, we were asked to offer an opinion as to whether the humanoid civilization on Mars was a threat to the humanoid civilization on Earth, was not a threat, or it could not be determined. And I remember when we were coming back from where we were sequestered to rejoin the group, Regina and I broke ranks and began to reveal she believed that the Martian population was a threat because they had actually several of our astronauts.
Bernie, you're typing there pretty furiously. That's coming across on air, mate.
Yeah. And I had...
mute your mic.
The Martian humanoid civilization was not a threat, that we were projecting our own fear on them. We were ignoring the fact that the hegemony going on was our civilization transgressing the sovereignty, the territoriality of civilization. And then Barack Obama wouldn't tell us what he had concluded in his thesis, and he ended up president, at least first. But anyway, so that was the end of sort of our period of seclusion there. I got to know both of them very well. It was almost like being on jury duty for 3 months with several same-age peers. And then we rejoined the group, and the program concluded, and we had a party, and we went our merry ways, and we wouldn't see each other sometimes for years. I didn't see Bernie again until 1982, 83 timeframe, when he started to perform the kinds of activities he was just describing in terms of really going out to the West Coast jump room and making that his base of operation. But I did have a number of jumps in the jump room and on the surface with Bernie, with Barack Obama, with Regina, with Brett, and also sometimes you would regroup with somebody else you hadn't jumped with, and you would perform different missions on the surface. And we have the name both of a naval attaché at the El Segundo, California jump room, the West Coast jump room, and we have the name of one of the other women that was in the jump that Bernie was describing. So we still
you talk about a jump room. Could you actually describe the room, or is it just kind of a nickname? It's not actually just a little room that you walk into, but what is it?
I don't know it as a jump room. I never heard the term jump room until I met Andrew. So they started using the term jump room when I met Andrew. That's when I first heard the term. I know it on the official nomenclature, which was like experiment in teleportation, transportation, U.S. government project number, very large, long number, 670523724A, experiment in teleportation, transportation, It was one paragraph long, took about half a page, but the paragraph was centered into the middle of the page. It was the cover sheet. I had a briefing man who would sit there and read that to me, just verbatim. That's why I remember it so well. And then he showed me the briefing document, and then I was briefed on what this was all about and what basically Andrew was saying. Andrew was in probably one of the most advanced jump rooms ever. I don't think he got any better than what Andrew was in, as far as I can tell. So I was, and a few other things besides that. And the East Coast wasn't as advanced as the West Coast. And there was Barry there. I remember Barry quite well. Made a few jumps with him. And this whole assessment that he's talking about, threat assessment, it's part of a thing that we had was called an assessment. The assessment was a bit overdue. Every so many years, they redo the entire project. The project was very big, involved a lot of different aspects to it. And it's a 10,000-page document, which is on a table about 8 or 10 feet long. And you have literally a book in there.
Yeah, Bernie, we're coming to break now. We'll get into more of that after. We're coming to break, so we'll get into that story just a little bit after it, ladies and gentlemen. You can join us in the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, live streams at americanfreedomradio.com. Be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto,
Winston, Missouri,
Ottawa, Oklahoma, Panama,
Madawa. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that goes everywhere, man. And there's a lot of people who would sit back, hear what Andrew's saying, instantly dismiss it as fiction, not wanting to look into it further. And I was thinking about this, Andrew, the difficulty with cases like these, particularly with black ops, is that when you turn a whistleblower, you come out, and of course you don't have artifacts or relics or things of a physical nature to show people. Like you didn't bring back an alien skull from Mars or any of these things, so that it becomes a story to people because they don't have an extra physical item to sort of back it up. But what I found is if you corroborate stories, okay, so if you've got people who otherwise wouldn't really have met and they're all saying the same thing, then it adds weight to it. And I was wondering, how many other people who have had these experiences, both you and Bernie, have come forward? Is it just you two, or how many other others are out there?
Well, I'm the principal whistleblower participant on Project Pegasus. Many of the mid-career professionals and the older engineers and physicists on that project are, in fact, deceased. Now, in terms of the jump room, which began 10 years later, or at least we entered it 10 years later, around 1980, we have really six informants, and we're going to eight. So that would be, in terms of those who have shared direct testimony about firsthand experience, which I would aver is, in fact, direct evidence. I mean, people are sent to jail. Indeed, people are sent to the gas chamber, to the gallows on the strength of direct testimony. So among those who have directly testified and provided direct evidence, therefore, of the notion of taking the jump room to Mars, that would be, or the proposition, would first be Michael Relf, who states that he first went up in 1976, and his is a complicated case where he states that he worked there for 20 years and then was age-regressed back in 1996. And rejoined his military unit 20 years after serving on Mars and being age regressed. Then I stepped forward, and then Project Camelot began revealing the experiences of Henry Deacon, who in fact is an individual by the name of Arthur Neumann. And then as a result of my Project Pegasus revelations, William B. Stilling stepped forward. And then when William Stillings and I were on Coast to Coast, Bernard Mendez stepped forward. But when we did step forward on Coast to Coast, we were joined by the great-granddaughter of President Dwight David Eisenhower, Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, who described how in 2006 and 7, she was subject to a sophisticated manipulation, essentially, where the U.S. government was trying to recruit her and her two twin boys to relocate to the secret Mars colony via ARC. And I think what they were talking about, and in fact Bernie confirmed this, which is the ARC was simply a reference to the fact that these jump rooms that they have set up in different parts of the world could be used to evacuate the population to Mars in the event of an emergency. So I believe that Laura was being offered the opportunity to go to Mars via jump room as well. But let me add, we now have the identity of the naval attaché at the West Coast jump room that the three of us interacted with. We can search for that person. And Bernie and I, through our memory work, have identified one of the other women that was in the night run that Regina was on. In fact, she was the woman who roomed with Regina when we took a nap at a barracks near the El Segundo jump site before doing that night run. And I should add, Vince, that you asked what the jump rooms were like, and maybe now would be appropriate time to describe what was there at El Segundo. What was there was the elevator that got you from the ground floor up to the fifth floor. We would then get out at the fifth floor, walk across this marble floor that, where there was a simple counter. There was one person working there for CIA, and we would provide our name, our date of birth, our social security number. I think I was providing my UCLA ID number as well as a student, and then signing the book indicating we were now going to jump. We would then go back in the elevator. The elevator would go to, up to the eighth floor, which is the top floor of that building, there at 999 North Sepulveda Boulevard in El Segundo, California. And we would feel as a sensation as if the jump room was moving horizontally. And we now know from physical inspection, from visual inspection, that there's kind of a pod that's attached to the southern side of the roof of that building. And then from there, we were still in the elevator chamber itself, but lights would begin flashing at the top and bottom panel of the elevator. And about 10 minutes into the jump, the box-like elevator would begin morphing into a cylinder shape. The side that was now the end of the cylinder had kind of a swirling look to it, like a wormhole. And we'd be in this high-pressure situation for about 5 minutes that was absolutely nauseating because we were being twisted with the jump room, yet not injured. Then it would untwist back in the opposite direction, in a spiral direction, so that the elevator then resumed its ordinary shape. About another 5 minutes would pass, and then the door would open, and we were on the surface of Mars, or whatever artificial holographic planetary domain they were sending to us to. But I should add that we all agree they were sending us off planet. So that was the jump room. The jump room was essentially the elevator of an office building in El Segundo, California that was controlled by Hughes Aircraft. They were either the owner-operator or the owner or the operator, but they were in that building in 1981 and in the early 80s. So it was Hughes Aircraft controlled. We conjecture that Howard Hughes himself may have been working on the jump room technology prior to his death in 1975. That links the building there to a major defense contractor that we know was working on these advanced aerospace projects. But in fact, the jump room was an elevator room. And that, I might add, that's perhaps why they were also sometimes calling, you know, Bernie mentioned, I think he had previously stated to us that in that official document he read, ultimately they boiled all that descriptive paragraph down to government transporter. We were calling it not a teleporter. We were calling it the jump room. But I also heard the term space elevator used several times. And indeed, it was an elevator. It was an elevator in a conventional office context in a beach community southwest of Los Angeles, and namely El Segundo. And yet it had that dual use of being able to somehow morph and be punched through a wormhole in time-space simultaneously to take us elsewhere. And it did. We're in agreement that it wasn't some virtual reality generator or some psyop that we were undergoing. We were going to an actual domain that we then explored. And it was relatively unbounded and far bigger than any virtual reality project ever could have been constructed on Earth. It was another place, another world.
Okay. I'm here to support Andrew. I stepped out because Andrew asked me to, and I had thought about it for quite some time. A lot of issues stepping out like this, very controversial. It wasn't just Andrew. I had been doing research into this matter because I get consulted with in the Navy from time to time. Because after Andrew went back to the Navy to the Camp Hero, and there were other jumps to be made for the reconnaissance, and then over the years, as a classification, because I was involved in the legal end before I met Andrew, the matters were classified for 30 years. They wanted to go 150 years, but then when I negotiated with the administration, most of it will be classified for 30 years, and then we see a lot of stuff on YouTube now about Apollo, which has been released for Senator McCain. People should write their congressman and tell them they want more a release concerning Apollo in the jump rooms, and they might release more. And then the matters were declassified, reworked, and then reclassified. And Andrew was talking about the threat assessment. It's really an assessment. They were assessing the threat because of the jumps that we made and the creatures that we found and the unknown areas. And we didn't know if they were a threat or not. And then there were more encounters with ET or aliens. On all the jumps I made, we always ran into some sort of alien. Grays were predominant on all of them. And then just before I met Andrew, this was being assessed. They were asking everybody across the board. So the assessment's across the board. Everyone takes the surveys, the questionnaire sometimes, and everyone's asked a lot of questions. And then you give them your opinion. Did you see this type of creature? Think they're hostile towards us? Are they friendly? Because sometimes some of these creatures would, you know, come over to you and start touching you and start talking to you and whatnot. They seem hostile. They seem friendly. They seem willing to talk to you.
Well, we're coming up to break again. It's kind of like whenever you get talking, Bernie, you keep going and keep going. I want you to keep expanding, and then bam, cut off like a parallel universe time loop. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, you lose your sense of humor. You go freaking nuts, man. We're on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. Archives at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com as well. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back for a whole other hour in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here on it.
Delete the virus. Alert the masses.
Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland. It's the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. As fluoridated and Fukushima irradiated, and everybody got a part-time job from the government as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guests are Bernie Mendez and Andrew Bosago. Bosago, like Chicago.
Like Chicago.
Bosago. Now let's see if I can think, because Bosago, when I think about the name, I kind of think about like a lone Bosago, you know, like a great white.
Vinny, because when I think of it, I think of a future American president. So maybe it's appropriate. Hey, we're on two different sides of the world.
Hey, and look at it this way. There's not a terribly large amount of difference between a loan shark and a president of the United States, is there? Fundamentally. speaking of breaking down to the fundamentals. Now, Andrew, I've heard a lot of talk about this incident with Alfred Weber at the just recently, bringing up your information at a 9/11 conference, something about a being chased with Barack Obama by some kind of dinosaur on Mars. I don't know what the full story is or what Alfred was talking about. I haven't had a chance to go into it. So if you'd actually be able to elaborate and actually tell that story here to the audience, maybe they'll give them certainly some background as well.
The air deserves to be cleared on that most important topic of 9/11. When I was a child in Project Pegasus, my father and I were called on an emergency basis to the laboratory maintained by the Aerojet Corporation on the New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology campus at the corner of Bullock Avenue and Leroy Place in Socorro. This was in 1971. And it was in that laboratory in which photo analysts working for Project Pegasus were photo analyzing not chronovision images, not in other words, not holographic images of the future, but information that had been physically ferried back to the present on microfilm, containing essentially a 70-year history of the future. Basically, there was a microfilm summaries of future events from the perspective of the early 70s, reaching to the year in which they were retrieved from the future and brought back, and that year was 2045. In fact, I participated in several of those probes to retrieve those canisters of microfilm from a Stargate device that was huge. It was a huge gate that was set up on the Olympic-sized basketball court at a WPA-constructed community center that's still standing in Cerrillos, New Mexico. If any of your guests visit Santa Fe, New Mexico, and they're driving around to the smaller communities, it's really immediately southeast of Santa Fe, these buildings. So we had been jumping forward in time, retrieving those canisters, jumping back from a teleport that was in the building there, and then popping back into view around the microwave tower at the Lobo Overlook Point, due west, 3 miles west of the Continental Divide sign on Highway 160 in southwest Colorado. And from there, we would surrender the microfilm canisters and then be bussed back to New Mexico. Now, when my father and I were called down to the location where that film was being analyzed, we were greeted in the hallway after my dad presented his Department of Defense credentials, and we were cleared by the guard with a gun sitting at the counter there at this C-shaped building there in Socorro, New Mexico. And it was an Aerojet Corporation facility. It had an Aerojet sign literally on the front grass. And in fact, I interviewed people working at the research library at New Mexico Tech who remembered that building and confirmed for me that it was there in the early 70s. And we were greeted in the hallway by a technician who said to my father in a very excited tone of voice, Ray, we've got it. We've got pictures of the event. We've got pictures of the domestic Pearl Harbor. So we were taken into a room there with about 20 different television monitors. And this individual took a Betamax-styled videotape upon which had been deposited some of the microfilm images. 10 years before Betamax tapes entered the commercial market, certainly. And what we witnessed was about a 20-second film loop of one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers on September 11th of 2001, 30 years in the future. Now, I also remember times when the 9/11 event, as domestic Pearl Harbor-like event within the continental United States, literally an attack on U.S. soil that such as had not been seen since the War of 1812, when, of course, the British troops burned down the White House. So this is a very significant event among the future events that they were gathering information about, because it was an attack, at least a terrorist attack, if not a military attack, on the U.S. homeland. And there were times when my father, as one of the highly placed engineers in the project, who was reading the reports, the internal reports in which they were summarizing what they knew of future conditions and events, he was sometimes asked what he knew about this event that people were talking about in the program called 9/11, and he was describing the conventional view of the event. So in furtherance of my duty to uphold the U.S. Constitution and my oath of truthfulness as a leader of the truth movement, and as somebody who simply was a material witness to prior knowledge by the U.S. government of the events of 9/11, indeed in a context in which the man who was defense secretary on 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld, was serving as defense attaché to the very project I was on that had retrieved this data from the future, proof or evidence of a 9/11 linked terrorist attack, or at least plane attack on the Twin Towers. I wrote a very factual, very concise, single space 10-page affidavit that I submitted to the Vancouver 9/11 Tribunal. The result was that three principal figures in the 9/11 movement, namely Professor James Fetzer, researcher Kevin Barrett, and Barbara Honegger, used the unusual nature of my claims in that affidavit to begin basically attacking me as a witness and commenting about my testimony, which violates the canons of of being a witness. You're not supposed to talk about other, you're not even supposed to know about other presidents. But they became aware of what I was claiming in my affidavit, began attacking me, began attacking the judge, which also violates the canons of legal ethics. And without even knowing that my story's true and the fact that Donald Rumsfeld was the defense attaché on a project that had moving pictures of the 9/11 attacks 30 years before they happened, they made this peremptory judgment that I must be a liar or some kind of intelligence agent trying to disrupt the 9/11 truth movement, when in fact I was a critical witness to it. And they most of them withdrew from the Vancouver 9/11 tribunal. Several of them, Fetzer and Barrett, went on to write these poison pen articles about me that totally distort my work, that distort my true experiences as a child participant in Project Pegasus, and as one of the chrononauts in the Jump Room program 10 years later, who has had the courage not only to participate in these projects in which new dangerous and experimental technology has been developed, but who had then political courage to step forward to my country and what the U.S. government has done with their tax dollars, namely achieve time travel, and then 10 years later use it to get to Mars. But along the way, as a child who sat in many project meetings, many strategy sessions, and also lunches and dinners and cocktail parties with people like some Manhattan Project scientists like Agnew and Teller and Segre, some of the federal science administrators like Dr. Agnew again, or Stephen J. Lukasik when he was director of DARPA, or Ivan Browning when he was director of science and technology for CIA, individuals like Mr. Rumsfeld, who was the defense attaché to the project. I mean, I was witness to history. I was witness to advanced professionals in the defense technical community developing time travel and using it to find things out about the future. Well, along the way, they uncovered visual evidence of the 9/11 attacks. Now, Alfred, as a judge, believes that that helps establish the mens rea, the legally culpable mental state, for Secretary Rumsfeld's duplicity in the 9/11 events. I don't believe that's the case. What the evidence shows is prior knowledge, and in an era of quantum access, where previously prior knowledge implied, created a rebuttable presumption that one was either a conspirator or an accomplice after the fact, that one had aided and abetted if one knew about a future criminal act. After the advent of quantum access, that's no longer true. All knowledge may mean is simply knowledge. One can be a government bureaucrat or technician and have evidence of a future event and have no mens rea to commit the event, not even to know about it in the conventional ways. What happened was I wrote a completely truthful affidavit about what Project Pegasus knew about this future domestic Pearl Harbor event called 9/11. I was diligent, spent a week of my own time taking time out from my law practice. I'm a lawyer in solo private practice. I support myself. I have for 16 years without a single complaint being filed by one of my clients, much less any kind of ethical allegation against me. And I took a week out to write a hard-boiled 10-page analysis of exactly what they need to do about Project Pegasus and what that project...
Oh, hold on, Andrew. Ben is shuffling around back there. He's kind of bleated you out there for a second. Bernie, you wanted to jump in here for a second, didn't you?
Yes. What Andrew's talking about is what we got from the chronovisors. We had some intelligence about this 9/11 event very early on, but we didn't know what it meant. There were different views of the whole subject. When we viewed it, it was viewed by a lot of people, and I did some reconnaissance myself at that particular jump. It was like the Lincoln jump, Forbes Theater. It was a reasonable facsimile of Forbes Theater because I had gone to the original Forbes Theater, measured it all out with a slide rule, with tape measures. And then when I made the jump, I measured it all out again, and it wasn't the same measurements. There were things that were missing. There were other things that were like had canvas curtains between the little booths. And the back hall was a little different. The stage was a little different. And things missing, like the floodlights, which were gas lights, and the fire brigade, and the water buckets or the sand buckets. and the rows and columns of the seats were different. It was very close. One to the untrained eye, one would say it was Forbes Theater. And that same theory applies to this 9/11 event, which they were questioning Andrew about. What we were viewing with that was something that was very similar, but the whole area in question was different. The buildings were different. Part of South Ferry was different, was missing. And that was a view from Atlantic Avenue down by the piers, Atlantic Avenue and Columbia Street in Brooklyn, where you would view South Manhattan. You could clearly see the towers from there. So that whole area, part of the waterfront was missing. The water itself was different, different color, and it wasn't choppy. And then South Ferry was different. And then the buildings were very similar, but different. They weren't exactly the same height. I counted all the floors. The floors weren't the same amount of floors. The building was very similar looking, but it was different. So Andrew was criticized for talking about this highly classified project. I was told never to discuss it. We didn't know what it meant or what had transpired. We didn't see planes crashing into the building, just the buildings collapsing at some point. They didn't seem to be on fire the same way, because this is now after the fact. We got tapes of the real event. So we had a very similar event on a chronovisor, but we didn't know what it meant. You know what I'm saying?
So yeah. It's kind of like
report what he
saw. It's kind of like, if I may, is it sort of like when you wake up from a dream where you've experienced what appears to be a parallel reality? When you come back, you're not sure if you're really awake or entirely sure what it is you saw in the first place.
Well, I'd say it's more real than that, but I had given a very accurate, because I was placed in these particular jumps, is my ability to go there, because my photographic memory at the time gives specific details about my surrounding area, the bridge across Atlantic Avenue. They call it the BQE, and the bridge was different. I gave all the...
Well, exactly how was it different? What was different about it?
Well, the length across the street was different. The bridge was slightly narrower. The roadway was a lot cleaner, a lot flatter. The bridge, the ribs on the different I-beams were different. It's arched, that bridge, a particular way, and it sits on pedestals, each I-beam. There weren't as many I-beams. There weren't as many pedestals. So it was a similar bridge, very close, but it wasn't it. And then the view South Manhattan that I gave, and the description of the building was different, because I had studied South Manhattan through pictures, as many pictures of South Manhattan taken from a helicopter or a plane, looking from Brooklyn or looking from the South Manhattan, from the Lower Bay, or the Upper Bay, as they call it, and then looking towards Manhattan, South Ferry, and the north. And there's a lot of views of Manhattan of that area. So it wasn't...
Well, like the iconic Manhattan buildings are like the Chrysler Building and the Twin Towers and of course the Empire State. Did they look like they were structurally different as well?
Well, I couldn't see as far as the Chrysler Building. I couldn't see that far up. I couldn't see as far as the Empire State Building. I couldn't see that far up, but I could see South Manhattan quite clearly, and then the seaport that's there, South Seaport. Parts of the Battery Tunnel were missing. And then between Manhattan, there's Governor's Island, because you have the Battery Tunnel not far away, which goes to, touches on Governor's Island, where there's a building for air recirculation, which sucks out the CO2 from the bottom and puts fresh air into the tunnel. That's about halfway between the Battery Tunnel from Brooklyn to Manhattan, or South Manhattan. We call it the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. That was missing. And a lot of other details, which, you know, I can give the South Ferry, which was actually a big missing.
Well, as is customary, Bernie, instead of letting you go on, we're going to cut to a break. This is like the third time this happens. It's classic. All right. Thank you, Bernie. Thank you, Andrew. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you touch that dial at AmericanFreedomRadio.com.
fucked out by insects and violence. A heavy baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but unless I let you give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie show. Might be a little bit bonkers, this crazy Will, but, you know, like I say, just keep your sense of humour about you. And also try to be nice to people, you know, and try to hear what they've got to say. And even if the air might not be cleared at the end of the day, it doesn't mean we shouldn't attempt it. Kind of like even if it's inevitable that we'll be enslaved and exterminated, doesn't mean you should not resist. My very special guests, Andrew Bashago and Bernie Mendez. Now, I also wanted to get Andrew's final take on this 9/11 situation with Alfred Weber and the responses from other people who have critiqued you for it. I mean, I definitely don't think you've quite finished speaking, Andrew, and I apologize. In retrospect, I probably should have let you finish, but yeah.
Oh, right. What happened was that quantum access enabled the U.S. Defense Department to get moving images and even to send individuals, including myself, I participated in some of those probes myself, from the future. Okay, so they were in possession of an awareness that there was going to be an attack in downtown Manhattan. Bernie just described some of the vagaries of when you're time traveling. Are you visiting that actual time and place or some semblance of it that exists in a slightly altered condition in a different state of existence? But the bottom line is that whether we were visiting downtown Manhattan on the actual 9/11 or a variant of the 9/11 events occurring elsewhere in time-space, that as an intelligence finding, the U.S. defense technical community passed along to the U.S. executive, embodied in the president and other cabinet officials, the military, and the intelligence community, prior knowledge of 9/11. Now, this is germane to the 9/11 controversy because at a minimum, it is probative of the notion that the government let it happen on purpose, the so-called LIHOP position, or alternatively, committed it on purpose. Basically, that it was an inside job, as Jim Mars has described it. I'm not taking a position because the information that I learned as a child in Project Pegasus didn't reveal who the perpetrators were. When my father described the event to his fellow engineers, he followed the conventional storyline, saying that it was Middle Eastern terrorists hijacked two commercial airliners and flew them into the Twin Towers that are just going up in New York City. This was in the early 70s when, you know, the Twin Towers were finished in 1971 and 73, respectively. So they were literally talking about these huge buildings that were such marvels of engineering at the time, at least as public works, you know, as tall skyscrapers. And the engineers in the project were listening to my father describe how they were going to be knocked down. In fact, my dad said, you know, commercial airliners are flown into the buildings and they come tumbling down like a ton of bricks. And then one of the engineers asked him, well, what happens then, Ray? And he said, well, the country picks itself up, dusts itself off, and goes on like nothing happened. So he didn't really have a real keen sense that 9/11 would be a major and ongoing political controversy, nor that wars in Afghanistan and Iraq would be perpetrated based on the 9/11 event, that the Patriot Act and the NDAA would be passed in the wake of 9/11 and so forth. He just knew about the event in the conventional parlance, as you might find out about it if 50 years from now Wikipedia never changed its conventional take on 9/11 and stuck to the original storyline that we were all fed back at the shortly after the event was perpetrated. But the critical thing is that a Defense Department intelligence project that Donald Rumsfeld was the defense attaché for. He was the point man. Project engineers like my father, physicists like, let's say, an Edward Teller, and federal science administrators like a Dr. Harold Agnew, was reporting to. I was present at a meet and greet, at a kind of a lecture that Don Rumsfeld gave to the child teleportees on the project when he described how we had to keep the technology secret and how the principal purpose of teleportation was military. It would allow the U.S. Army to put troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield. So in this Cold War project context, very, very sensitive information was learned, in this instance, about 9/11. So when I brought it forward and really taking pains to write a long affidavit that would explain my background in the project, what Project Pegasus was, I described the different forms of time travel it researched and developed, and I gave the entire background for them to understand the 9/11 incident in Project Pegasus. These leading lights of the 9/11 truth movement so mishandled my information and so engaged in unethical conduct that Fetzer ended up accusing me of being an accomplice after the fact to the 9/11 event. Barrett wrote this farcical article for Veterans Today in which he mocked my claims about the Jump Room program. And here on your show, I'm bringing one of my co-participants, Bernard Mendez, who was literally Richard Nixon's go-to guy regarding the extraterrestrial situation. So here I've marshaled my co-participants in these several defense technical projects I was involved in as a child and as a young man. I've been truthful all the way along. I shared information that the entire 9/11 truth movement should be concerned about, and that is Rumsfeld's prior knowledge. That's always been an issue. And yet they pilloried me with condign misinformation and disinformation to obscure this most important data point. Now, I'm not going to criticize another witness because that's the unethical conduct that they've investigated in. I took an oath of attorney in 1996 not to subvert, among other things, to prosecute the cause of justice, which involves, and upholding the U.S. Constitution, I might add, which involves when you are a witness in an official judicial proceeding, not commenting on the evidence out of court and not commenting on other witnesses and their testimony. So I won't discuss their testimony or their take on mine. All I can say is I upheld my duty as a member of the bar. I upheld my duty as a citizen, and I upheld my duty as a human being to tell the world that this DARPA project had prior images of one of the planes striking one of the Twin Towers. And they want to conceal that now, and that's not appropriate. The truth has been told, and I will take my position all the way to the ICC if I have to, because it is the truth.
Okay, well, I mean, that's...
I'm only angry because they basically attacked me as a witness, and I hadn't even been cross-examined yet. That's not legitimate.
You sound particularly upset, and
I am.
I have the same thing, man. The thing that irritates me the most is when people accuse me of something that I haven't done.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing that incenses me and inflames me the most. I get real angry real quickly because I want to say the truth and I want to get it out there. But it's like, how can you do this? You know, it doesn't make any sense. And because it doesn't make any sense, it's crazy. So it drives you nuts. You know what I'm saying?
I did the principled thing relative to my time travel revelations, and I didn't insert myself into the 9/11 truth movement. I could have. I could have described this connection years ago, but I didn't because I knew if I did, just like we saw in this incident, I was pulled down the rabbit hole of ridiculousness about the causes of the 9/11 event by them. So I didn't want to. I was already investigating my experiences in Project Pegasus for a year and a half or so when 9/11 occurred. And so I knew as the debate over 9/11 fomented, as the books were written, as the conferences were held, if I articulated publicly what's in that 10-page affidavit, my entire truth campaign about the advent of time travel would have been subsumed under the umbrella of speculation and now ridicule and defamation regarding 9/11. But was I under a duty to ultimately historically reveal this information? Of course. Rumsfeld was defense secretary on 9/11. He had been the defense attaché to Pegasus. We knew him personally. I was at multiple social engagements in bars, in hotel drawing rooms, at dinner, at lunch, with Donald Henry Rumsfeld. In fact, I called him Rummy one time, and he said, "No, Andy, call me Don. I don't want you calling me Rummy." Of course, because he didn't want one of the kids in the project to be making a reference, you know, to alcohol, potentially, at least in terms of its inference. So I'm saying that how could I go to my grave not making the 9/11 connection when Rumsfeld was both the defense secretary in 9/11 and literally the point man on behalf of the Pentagon to this secret defense project. It's clearly germane to the investigation. And to ridicule me after I wasn't even cross-examined as a witness, I haven't even appeared before the ICC yet, is highly unethical. Because there was a capability for Alfred and his co-judge, Connie Vogel, to cross-examine me, but that wasn't even permitted before Fetzer and Barrett were publishing these hit pieces in the internet news realm. That's totally unethical. They didn't even send me any questions saying, hey, what's the deal here? Do you expect us to believe this? And I would have agreed to be cross-examined by them as fellow witnesses, but they never have. They never questioned me. They didn't send me a single email before writing farcical pieces to discredit a fellow witness who brought forward what will probably be considered critical information establishing prior knowledge on the part of the U.S. government.
Can I ask you, Andrew, let's say you're not you and somebody who like you comes forth with this kind of information and you're cross-examining them, what would be the questions you would ask and how would you answer them?
I would just go into every last claim. My approach to sharing my information about Pegasus has been inundated. So if as PhDs, Fetzer and Barrett know anything about evidence, they would have taken my claims one by one and done close questioning. But that didn't even occur. I mean, they could have been deputized as, I don't know, as prosecutors or given some kind of capacity, even on a pro tem basis, to question me because this information is so controversial and incendiary. I would have said, you know, I would have gone into my claims. I would have asked about alternate explanations. I would have been asked the $64,000 question, which is, why did you wait 10 years or more to come forward with this data? I would have really grilled myself. But the thing is, I was ready, willing, and able to be grilled by Judge Weber, by Judge Fogel, or by any of my fellow witnesses, or even before the International Criminal Court. And I still am available to the ICC to be questioned. I simply gave this testimony because it was the truth. I don't even know to a dispositive certainty who perpetrated 9/11. I mean, there are some people who believe it was the U.S. administration. Other people believe it was the Israelis. Other people believe it was the Saudi regime. Other people believe it was extremists, terrorists. I don't know. I wasn't advancing a theory of who perpetrated 9/11. I was simply providing evidence based on firsthand experience that proves that a cabinet official in the Bush administration, namely Donald H. Rumsfeld, at a minimum, had prior knowledge of the event, because he had to have, because he was more highly placed in Pegasus than my dad was. And one time we walked into a bar in Albuquerque, and my dad and Rumsfeld talked about the fact that Rumsfeld had been identified as a future defense secretary. And Don said, I saw that, Ray, in one of the reports, but let me tell you, that's one future event. I'll only believe when it happens. That means that Don Rumsfeld was reading the intelligence reports about future events that Project Pegasus was passing along to CIA. That means he would have read about this huge event in U.S. history where the two tallest buildings in the world were knocked down in downtown Manhattan, and 3,000 people died just in that event, and wars were prosecuted against two foreign countries. Okay, so my data shows that Rumsfeld knew. On 9/11 of 2001, Rumsfeld knew the event was coming. That explains why, for example, he changed his desk to the other side of the Pentagon, because he apparently had prior knowledge that the Pentagon was going to be struck on the side of the Pentagon where his desk had previously been, etc. So I'm not saying I know who did it. It may have been another faction altogether. It may have been a reinsurance scam by an organized criminal network. I don't know. And in the event, I wasn't giving the answer of who I thought did it. I was saying my father described it in conventional terms as being Middle Eastern terrorists hijacking commercial airliners to achieve a political end by committing this mass act of terrorism against the United States of America. But I don't know who committed the event. All I was providing was the information showing that on 9/11, a critical figure in the Bush administration, somebody standing, six heartbeats away from the presidency itself, Donald Rumsfeld, was, in fact, had knowledge. What the law would go, I think when Alfred refers to mens rea, he means knowledge. Because mens rea, or the legally culpable mental state, under the common law, encompasses both intent and knowledge. I don't think it means he says I don't think he's interpreting the data to say that Rumsfeld intended the axe. I think he simply means that he has what the common law used to call scienter. That is, a legally cognizable knowledge that such an event was going to occur in the future, or indeed on that 9/11. But my information is true, and I don't ultimately regret the testimony, because ultimately people don't matter. You know, as Jacques Cousteau, Captain Cousteau said, you know, individuals don't really matter. What matters is principles, purposes, and projects. And my purpose was to tell the truth so people knew that the U.S. government had prior images of the 9/11 attacks, and that a principal cabinet official serving on that day had what the common law called scienter regarding the event. So I'll take my knock on that.
Okay, and we'll be right back. The final segment coming up, and Bernie has a few things to cross-reference and jot in here before we finish the show today, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned at AmericanFreedomRadio.com.
Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah, sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time, it's business time.
It's business, it's business time.
That's what you mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business, it's business time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Welcome That's back, right. Ladies and gentlemen.
We go brush our teeth.
You're that's listening to the sexiest 2 hours in talk radio. Show that's all about business time and getting down to it with your business socks. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Very special guests, Andrew Bishago, and just like Chicago, and Bernie Mendez. Now, we've only got a final segment here, so... Is there any final things you'd like to wrap up, gentlemen? I mean, Andrew, what about you? I mean, do you feel that you've said enough about any particular issue that needs more expanding on, or final message to listeners? Or
I think I'd like to say that I spoke at length today about the controversy regarding my 9/11 affidavit. I have to say that establishing one position or the other regarding 9/11 is not the thrust of my truth campaign, and I won't allow it to become that. I've been speaking out because the U.S. government achieved a time-space exploration capability over 40 years ago, and for the last 40 years or 42 years since 1970 or so, we could have been relying on Tesla-based portal teleportation to move around between major world cities. So think of the implications of that. Think of the implications of the fact that when Vice President Al Gore of the United States was sitting in his first greenhouse effect lectures with Dr. Roger Revelle as a Harvard undergraduate in 1970, the U.S. defense technical community had already developed a revolutionary form of transportation that, if applied globally, could obviate about 60% of the human contribution of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, when we look at things like solar activity, volcanoes, etc. So the United States has sat on a revolutionary transportation technology that could literally clear up our skies and prevent the runaway greenhouse gas effect, the runaway climate change that might result in a new ice age, for which the U.S. government and now other world governments are secretly spraying the chemtrails and poisoning all of us with oxides of aluminum and barium, and now we think maybe even strontium. So I'm not speaking out to have an effect on the 9/11 debate. It really is a minor dimension of my truth campaign. I've been speaking out because I want to advantage humanity by persuading the United States government to declassify and deploy in a global program of technology transfer its secret teleportation technology. And in fact, that's why I've decided to seek the presidency of the United States in 2016, because I think what we found, certainly in my country, I don't know if it's true of other countries, but we're simply not electing to high office the individuals who can have a catalytic change in society and galvanize the people to pursue the kind of revolutionary change we're going to need to save our civilization. It's the kind of leadership that President Kennedy evinced when he challenged the United States in 1961 to put a man on the moon and return him safely to the earth by the end of the decade of the 1960s. We're going to have to set similar goals. And so I'm in this for the duration. I'm going to be running for president in 2016, calling for U.S. leadership in developing a new energy paradigm with the very vortal teleportation that we pioneered in Project Pegasus as the centerpiece of my platform, of essentially revealing it, constructing a program of technology transfer, to work a public-private partnership, to implement it, and to share it with other countries. So I just wanted to make that clear that I think we are in an emergency, and it's not necessarily who or who did not perpetrate 9/11. That's a very important ethical and moral and legal and political issue. But I think a more important issue, and in fact, one of the project engineers on Project Pegasus, Dr. Robert Beckwith, shared this opinion. Human adoption of teleportation, what he called levitated teleportation, which by which he meant the Tesla teleportation that opens up portal tunnels in time-space, through which the teleportee passes, which was the form of teleportation that I was using to get back and forth between New Jersey and New Mexico in Project Pegasus. Declassifying that technology and adopting it as our principal form of transport may literally be the most important environmental issue of our time. And as a Cambridge-educated environmental lawyer, that's what I'm pursuing, that goal. But along the way, I had to tell the truth about things I learned when I was a child on the time travel project and then a young adult on the jump room project, and that's what I'm doing. So I was shocked by the reaction to my 9/11 affidavit, because really the thought that I would like to leave your listenership with, if during this conversation they've tended to disbelieve me as somebody telling a tall tale, for example, we have to remember that between what falls between what the people have been told that governments have secretly developed and what they have, in fact, secretly developed, falls everything that's covered under the umbrella of state secrecy, besides nuclear weapon development. And in the United States, our brightest physicists have had 65 years and trillions of dollars to do that research and development in that area between the publicly known and that which is kept officially secret. And so I would say that to two brilliant PhDs in history, like Drs. Fetzer and Barrett, what about that proposition that secrecy has existed not just to hide the latest generation of nuclear weapons or how to construct or deliver a nuclear warhead, but everything else they've been spending trillions of dollars on? And that, in fact, in the United States was time travel. And we have to go back and rediscover that technology if we are to save ourselves, not from the fallout from 9/11, which is serious enough, but if we are to save ourselves from destruction as a civilization, resulting from population and our unmet human needs, which can only prompt warfare if we don't come up with dynamic solutions to address the crisis of environment and development that's upon us. Between the present year and 2045, we're going to go from 7 billion to 9 billion human beings on our planet. And that's why I'm going to do everything I can to reveal what Project Pegasus achieved and to achieve the declassification and deployment of teleportation.
Okay. So, Bashago 2016, I presume you'll be running as a interdimensional.
I may borrow that from you, Vinny, but no. It's Andy 2016. I don't want to even get into the surname issues when I'm running for president. We found out about those today. I'm simply running as Andy 2016. I'm going to initially be seeking the independent vote for president, which is already 50% of the American people, and by 2016, it'll be 75%. I guarantee you.
Yeah. Well, there's that. I've always voted. I've always thought that it would be great to have two parties introduced. Firstly, the apathy party, which would win by landslide every election, and the other being the clown party, where you would get up on the podium with all the other candidates in a big clown suit with the red nose and the floppy shoes and all that, and the flower that squirts water at people and everything. And you say, vote for me, ladies and gentlemen. I'm way less corrupt than the rest of these clowns.
Well, you know, that would be fun. I wish I had another lifetime to do that, just for the fun of that. But I think it's going to be either, I'm either going to be running in a presidential or vice presidential slot with Jesse Ventura. So I think it's going to be kind of an Andy-Jesse or Jesse-Andy formulation. So that's the first time I've predicted that publicly. I think that's what we're looking at based on our early polling. I think that might be an unassailable ticket, especially since both of us will be in our apogee as figures in the truth movement by 2016.
Well, let's hope there's some people out there that might be willing to investigate and listen to what you've got to say, because I think let's look at it this way. You absolutely believe that it's true, and you're telling your straight testimony. You're not equivocating. You're not mincing your words. Your story doesn't change. It still remains the same. It's one of the hallmarks of a witness who's telling the truth, isn't it?
Yeah, and I have no other explanation for the keloid scars on my chest, shoulders, and back when I get up and brush my teeth in the morning. Yeah. So,
well, see, unfortunately, yeah. We've come to the end of the show today here, so we've got about maybe 40 seconds or so. Bernie, have you got something quickly to share with the listeners? Have you guys got websites and such that we can find you at?
My website is UFOQANDA.com.
And I'll
see you in the future.
Pegasus.net and ProjectMars.net.
Pegasus.net
and ProjectMars.net.
Yeah, and you can also look it up on Facebook as well. I'm actually a member of the group that you've got going there. So thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming forth. I know that it can be when you have information that you don't... that people will be highly critical of because of its varied nature, it makes stepping forward that much harder, but it makes you that much stronger for doing it. And I just want to honor and acknowledge you gentlemen for it, and also invite you on again at some point to expand further, because there's a lot of tangents and different parallel things that come into it, and we need to really take the time to expand on it in full detail and relaxed depth that it needs to be. So, again, thank you. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in. The archives of the show will be on the YouTube channel Mr. News Guerrilla Media and also posted at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all your support.